A report from Statistics Canada released in May of 2019 shows that Halifax had the highest rate of police-reported human trafficking in the country. Senior Crown Attorney Josie McKenney of the Nova Scotia Public Prosecution Service specializes in human trafficking, and her role is to take cases after the police have investigated them and to guide victims through the court process. Today we ask McKenney all sorts of questions to get a better understanding of human trafficking in the Nova Scotia region and to debunk many of the common misconceptions.
My name is Josie McKenney. I'm a senior Crown Attorney at the Nova Scotia Public Prosecution Service, and right now I'm assigned to the role of Crown Attorney dedicated to doing human trafficking prosecutions. And my role as a Crown Attorney, as is every role, every Crown Attorney's role, is to take cases after police have investigated them and to guide them through the court process.
So where in Canada are the most reported cases of human trafficking? Or is it Ontario?
So the sheer number of cases that are reported is in Ontario. Nova Scotia has the highest rate of human trafficking, and that's the rate of human trafficking is a reflection of the number of reported incidents per every 100,000 people. So our rate is higher because we have more reported incidents per population. It's difficult to say why Nova Scotia would have a higher rate of human trafficking. It's important to keep in mind that the Statistics Canada, whose reports on the rates of human trafficking, is including charges under the Criminal Code of Human Trafficking and charges of human trafficking under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. So those are two different pieces of legislation. So the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act accounts, charges under that legislation account for, I think, something like 30 or 40% of all reported cases in Nova Scotia. And what that would certainly be a sign of is that Nova Scotia, particularly Halifax, being a point of entry into the country would be a contributing factor to those numbers. And then the other factor that we know in through our stakeholders is that Nova Scotia is a part of a corridor to bringing victims into other parts of the country. So a lot of the victims from Nova Scotia will be taken through from Halifax or other parts of Nova Scotia up to Moncton, New Brunswick, because that's the closest place where legal strip clubs run. And so traffickers will try out a victim in Moncton first. And if it's if the person is successful there, then they'll transport them to other provinces like Quebec, Ontario, Alberta, or Newfoundland, which is known as the circuit.
How do human traffickers get their victims? Does it happen during the day, during the night? How do they target these young men and women?
So it has nothing really to do with time of day. So part of the challenge, I think, is folks have this a false image about what human trafficking looks like, which is that they think people are being taken, like the movie Taken, or that they're being pulled off the street or captured, kidnapped, those sorts of things. That's extremely rare. Most human trafficking happens through what's called the boyfriend method, which is a trafficker befriending or building an initial relationship with someone who's going through a difficult time in their life, and then in that they shower them with attention and affection and make that person feel like this is the greatest boyfriend they've ever had, and then that relationship is then transitioned into an exploitive relationship once they've earned that victim's trust. So it's actually a very long seductive process as opposed to a violent or volatile process. It doesn't mean that violence won't eventually become a part of the equation, but a lot of the cases that we see both in Nova Scotia and elsewhere are mental and emotional coercion and manipulation.
In your experience, what are the ages you're seeing for human trafficking? What are the most common ages from youngest to oldest?
So on a national level, the average age for victims is 18 to 25. That's the age range that's targeted the most. In my experience in Nova Scotia, I'm seeing victims much younger than 18. So we're seeing teenagers ages 13 to 18 seems to be the most common age range that we're experiencing in our active prosecutions right now. So essentially children.
What are the top risk factors for victims of human trafficking?
I think it's important for people to keep in mind that any person can be targeted by a trafficker, child, adult, male, female, non-binary. Certainly any person can be targeted, but certainly traffickers do prey on people in society that we have marginalized, that society has marginalized and made more vulnerable because of systemic discrimination. So we do see girls and gender diverse folks, so members of the 2S LGBTQ plus community are targeted, and women, girls from the Indigenous and African Nova Scotian communities are targeted more often. And again, that's because we as a society have marginalized those communities. And so traffickers feel like that they're not going to be looked for or missed, which is not true. Of course, we miss those people, but that's sort of the culmination of all of those centuries of discrimination towards those communities.
Speaking of systemic discrimination and missed people, I want to know, is there a direct, what is the correlation between missing people and victims of human trafficking? Is there a direct correlation?
So sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. So not all missing persons are persons connected to trafficking. Sometimes a person is missing for other reasons. And we do know from the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry that some of those missing persons are murdered. So it's not necessarily tied to trafficking, but sometimes it is. That's certainly when you go through the MMIW inquiry and the findings that they made and the recommendations that they made, there is certainly a connection between historic discrimination towards Indigenous people, particularly Indigenous women and girls, those members of those communities being targeted for sexual exploitation and for trafficking as well, all of those things together can make a person more vulnerable to be targeted for other types of violent crimes, such as murder. But it would not be true to say that every missing person's case necessarily is a person who's being trafficked. There can be a connection, but not always.
And can you share some laws and policies when it comes to fighting human trafficking in courts?
So as I mentioned earlier, so there's two pieces of legislation that are primarily about the charges of human trafficking. So the criminal code, which charges the actual offense of human trafficking. And so there's some key charges under that, which is mostly what I deal with. So it's human trafficking of adults, trafficking of children, and then receiving a material benefit from human trafficking, which just essentially means profiting in some way. It could be you're receiving drugs as a result of the trafficking, rent. In some way, you're receiving some type of benefit from it. And then the other charge is destroying a travel or identification document in order to further human trafficking. So it may be that one of the ways that a trafficker might keep a hold of someone is by stealing or destroying their identification or passport, which it makes it that much harder for that person to get away from that person or to be able to find their way back home. Because of course, we know that you need identification in order to buy a bus ticket, to get on a plane, to get on a train, et cetera. So those are the core offenses of human trafficking. And there are similar type offenses under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, although I don't handle those offenses because those would be handled by the Federal Crown Attorney's Office.
And how do these cases go in court? Would you say most of the time they're successful or unsuccessful?
So the role of a Crown Attorney is to not try to get a prosecution, or to get a conviction. Our role is ultimately to pursue a fair outcome for the case and to make sure that if we are taking a matter to trial, that there's sufficient evidence to do that, that there is sufficient evidence to convict a person. And so success from our measurement is not, at the end of the day, about conviction, although certainly from a victim standpoint and from an accountability standpoint, convictions can lead to sentences and lead to that some form of accountability and consequence and protection. But it's also a success if that person who is a survivor of trafficking gets connected with supports and services to go on with their life, to find a way that gives them meaning and a sense of appreciation and value. And so we don't like to look at it as success only being conviction. Part of the things that we're doing here in Nova Scotia is connecting with community supports and community agencies, same with the police, in order to help do that, to take a person who has survived trafficking, but who maybe wants to move their family to a different place to get a new start, maybe wants to go back to school. So even if they never report it to the police, or they never want to go through the official court process, but they reach out to us to get connected to other services, that is a success. So success is, I think it's important that we all consider success as being defined from the perspective of a survivor and not defined from the perspective of people who work in government, who are looking to collect statistics.
What resources are being used to end human trafficking or decrease it, so to speak?
So a huge piece, what's happening in Nova Scotia, is this collaboration I just mentioned. So one of the things I think it's important to mention is that Nova Scotia has the Trafficking and Exploitation Services System, or TESS for short. And that is a network that is essentially facilitated by the YWCA. And it has stakeholders all across the province who serve survivors of trafficking in different ways. And so the idea is to bring all of us to the table to try to brainstorm ways that we can collaborate and break down barriers for both, not just success in prosecuting the files, but as I said, success in supporting someone in them achieving the goals that are important to them. So that's a huge tool. That collaboration, that relationship building is such a huge tool, and it has been very successful. And then in our office, we created a case conferencing protocol in the last couple of years, and an advisory committee directly bringing those community agencies to the table in order to do wraparound supports for victims who are going through an active prosecution.
I'm curious. So over the years, human trafficking has been increasing, not decreasing, or even remaining stagnant. I wonder, is that because, is there a lack of information? Is there a lack of resources? What is the reason that it's increasing?
So it's probably complicated, but I think it's important to keep in mind that the numbers that we're seeing that are increasing are reported cases. So we've always known that human trafficking is one of the most underreported cases for a number of reasons. The stigma associated particularly to sex work and sex trafficking, as well as fear and the trauma bond that they form with their trafficker. But those increase in numbers that we're seeing could also be a reflection of people trusting in that system now to come forward and increased awareness. So there will be, I think, we can expect a time as we continue to build public awareness and then we continue to improve the way that we respond, we are going to see an increase in reported cases. That doesn't necessarily mean actual human trafficking is increasing, just people are starting to trust and reach out. So hopefully that is the predominant reason for it, as opposed to necessarily trafficking itself increasing. It's hard to say, but that is one of the things that myself and our community stakeholders are, we predict that to be the reason behind the increase.
And what are some of the signs that we need to look out for if we suspect someone is being human trafficked?
So some of the things that you can notice is that if the person that you know has suddenly developed a relationship with someone new, so it could be a new friend or a new romantic relationship that they seem almost obsessed with, that they talk about that person as being the greatest person they've ever met or the greatest relationship that they've ever had. And then that person becomes slowly more and more isolated. Seeing your friend or your loved one, having expensive things that you can't quite understand how they can afford. So having their nails done or their hair done, expensive clothing or purses, that can be something that the trafficker is purchasing for them in order to build trust with them. Seeing radical changes in behavior. So if someone was doing really well in school and suddenly they're not, someone was really social very involved with their friends, suddenly they're not. And that being tied to this new relationship that they have. So those doesn't necessarily mean that that is trafficking, but that is some of the signs that we see when we have friends and family reporting it. And so if you do suspect someone that you care about or that you love is being trafficked, calling the provincial human trafficking tip line, it's run 24/7. That is a key thing that a person can do. And it's better to trust your instinct and be wrong, because the police are not going to be upset if you call that line because of that suspicion. It's better to trust that instinct and be wrong than to not reach out and potentially that person get more and more involved with that trafficker and harder and harder to intervene.
We didn't touch on methods of prevention. What are some ways we can protect ourselves or be safe?
I think really at the end of the day, it's about understanding what those methods are, understanding those methods of warning. And if, you know, for parents or, you know, to talk to people, to, you know, if someone has that new relationship that seems troubling or spending time with someone that seems troubling, to if you're a parent, talk to your kids. If you're an adult, talk to your friends, and be there and be supportive, be non-judgmental. Don't try to force someone out of a situation. Meet them with where they're at, wherever they happen to be at in that journey, but to be aware, to try to connect, and let them know that you're going to be there no matter what the decision is.
And I guess I just wanted, are there any misconceptions you want to share or any interesting stories or facts you think the public should know or would be interested to know?
So I guess I would say, you know, the big one is that human trafficking, it is not going to look like what you think it is. It's not going to look like people being kidnapped and held in cages. It is going to be that manipulative relationship. Almost always it's going to be that manipulative relationship by a trafficker or someone pretending to be a boyfriend or a loved one. So that's the first misconception. The second misconception is that it is only people from quote unquote certain communities. Any child or adult can be trafficked. And so don't presume that if you come from a wealthy family or et cetera, that can't happen in your family. Yes, they are targeting vulnerable people, but it's not something that we should only expect of certain communities. So it could be anyone. So those would be two misconceptions that I would say that are important to recognize.
Sarah Gouda, CKDU.